One day in 1887, a young man saddles his horse and goes out riding. Perhaps the horse is spooked or stumbles, and the young man is thrown hard to the ground. He loses consciousness, and when he recovers, he learns that he is hopelessly crippled. He retires to his modest ranch in southwestern Uruguay, where he is visited one night by a writer of his acquaintance. The writer finds him lying on a cot, immersed in darkness, smoking a cigarette, and reciting in a high-pitched voice the words of a Latin treatise. After an exchange of pleasantries, the young man, whose name is Ireneo Funes, brings up another outcome of his accident. It seems he now possesses an imperishable memory. Everything, from an object's form to its shadow, every experience and how he feels about it, is filed away precisely as it occurs. He can recall not only every leaf on every tree of every wood, but even every one of the times he had perceived or imagined it. He can learn any language in a matter of hours, reconstruct all of his dreams, and has in fact reconstructed an entire day, minute by tumultuous minute. I have more memories in myself alone than all men have had since the world was a world, he tells the writer. The two men talk through the night, and when the sun rises, the writer, for the first time, makes out Funes's face. He seems more ancient than Egypt, older than the prophecies and the pyramids. And suddenly, the writer realizes the cost of owning an implacable memory, a memory that never allows us to forget, a memory that calls into question the very purpose of remembering. To get to Mr. Kessler's neighborhood in the Bronx from Columbia University, you take the one train to 231st Street and transfer to a bus. The trip takes about 40 minutes, enough time for me to wonder, on my first ride uptown, whether I'd made a mistake. Had I really left graduate school to look after a 98-year-old man? I told myself I was a temporary fix, someone to help Mr. Kessler around the house, until his son Sam found a more permanent solution. But as the weeks wore on and Mr. Kessler's equilibrium was jarred time and again by confusion and emotional outbursts, I became increasingly invested in his struggle. His swings from clear-headedness to bewilderment, sometimes within minutes, made me wonder why caregivers like Sam find profound memory loss so hard to acknowledge, much less accept. Sam's relationship with his father had been fractious from the time he had announced, at 21, that he was going to be a professional musician. He had picked up a saxophone at 12 and discovered he loved the sound it made. He prevailed upon his father to buy him one and taught himself to play by listening to records and hanging out with other young musicians. Mr. Kessler didn't mind Sam making noise in the house, but playing music was no way of making a living. Sam needed to get a job first and play music second. But Sam had no interest in working. His job, he told his father, was playing the tenor sax. "What kind of job is that?" Mr. Kessler had retorted. "You need to work in an office. Be an adult. Adults don't sleep in the day and stay up all night." But Sam did stay up most nights. He joined various bands, playing in one night spot after another, making just enough money to get by. When Sam tried to explain what jazz meant to him, Mr. Kessler would shake his head and mutter, "Words, words." What worried him was that Sam's life was unstructured, his career uncertain, and that he had never married. A Holocaust survivor, Mr. Kessler was a curious mixture of certainty and vulnerability, of innocence and obstinacy. He behaved as if he knew everything, perhaps because everything he had once known had been so brutally snatched away. Perhaps, too, this is why many survivors became over-invested in their children. For them, having children was a kind of vindication, a form of resistance against the Nazis. Although this was never alluded to by Mr. Kessler, it might partly explain why he wanted more than anything else that Sam should lead what Mr. Kessler considered a normal life.